Join left, right, and center host Bob Scheer for his new podcast, Scheer Intelligence. The twice-monthly podcast features thinkers and trendsetters in conversation with one of political journalism's leading voices. Through the show's unique and sometimes surprising perspectives, you'll get up to speed on the current issues shaping the Beltway and the world. Find Scheer Intelligence on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Hillary Clinton, tough and tested, not always trusted. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is a special edition of To the Point from Public Radio International, a profile of presidential candidate Hillary Rodham Clinton. One of the world's most famous people, the former senator and secretary of state, has a resume designed for the White House, but it also comes with a record that's opened challenges from Republicans and from the left of her own party.
I'm a progressive. But I'm a progressive who likes to get things done.
We'll hear about feminism, civil rights, the trials of a first lady, and how a thick skin can become a liability as well as an asset. Today's talking point, Iran's latest elections, is the victory of moderates more than skin deep. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Marvin Alney back with a special edition of To the Point, a profile of Hillary Rodham Clinton, tough and tested, but not always trusted. If elected, she would be America's first woman president, a historic prospect she downplayed in her campaign in 2008. Not anymore.
Clearly, I'm not asking people to vote for me simply because I'm a woman. I'm asking people to vote for me on the merits. And I think one of the merits is I am a woman and I can bring those views and perspectives to the White House.
Jay Newton-Small is a political correspondent for Time magazine. She's author of Broad Influence, How Women Are Changing the Way Washington Works. Good to have you on our program.
Hi, Warren. How are you?
What are the views and perspectives that Hillary Clinton is offering this time around that she did not offer in 2008 that suggest you to say she's running this time as a woman?
Well, in 2008, her main strategist, Mark Penn, worried very much about this toughness test, which is something that all women who are running for executive office, whether it's in the private sector or the public sector, face. And that is the idea that as a chief executive, or in the case of President of the United States, you have to show that you're tough enough to make command decisions, to make executive decisions, particularly, you know, as a woman in the sense of being a commander-in-chief, and so having your finger on the button at that time of the month and not unnecessarily bothered Russia. And so for in 2008, that was something that really preoccupied her campaign, and they felt very worried that if she showed too much emotion or if she played up the fact, the historic nature of her campaign too much, that people would be turned off, that people would think, oh, she's a woman, she can't actually govern. And so they emphasized instead, you know, how tough she was and how capable she was. Her campaign motto was ready from day one, and she campaigned with lots of generals, and she was sort of talking always about her foreign policy experience and her chops on all kinds of different, you know, toughness fronts and national security problems. And nowadays, it's such a striking difference. You see her, you know, almost every single event is almost all women. At least her audiences are at least 60% women. Every single event, she talks about equal pay. She talks about child care. She talks about issues that are very important to women. And at every single event, you have people introducing her, emphasizing, saying she would be the first female president of the United States, and she is changed because of that. And so that is her argument against Bernie Sanders, is who's saying, I'm the revolution. Well, she says, you know, Hillary's response is, I am the revolution because I'm a woman and I would be the first female president.
Is she less hawkish this time around?
I mean, she still talks about foreign policy, and you see her in the debates with Bernie Sanders, but it's strikingly not the focus. I mean, she does mention it in campaigns, you know, on the campaign trail, but it's not the absolute focus the way it was in 2008, where she was, you know, running advertisements against, you know, Barack Obama saying, you know, are you going to be ready at 3 o'clock in the morning to take that call? It was much more of an issue, I think, in 2008 than it is now. I mean, now she's been Secretary of State. She's much more relaxed about her chops and her bona fides to do this job. So she feels more, you know, available to run authentically as, you know, a woman, as a woman who's fought for women and girls for her entire career, as she argues she has.
We've seen that there was a kind of backfire when she brought Madeleine Albright and Gloria Steinem forward as people who were ultimately seen, apparently, by many young women as hectoring old ladies. How does she avoid that image, and what's the problem there?
Well, Hillary, so just as much as she's gotten over the toughness test to some degree, she also still has to meet that likability test, right? So, okay, maybe you're tough enough to be commander-in-chief, but you still have to be likable. And I think that that's a real challenge for her, and that's always been a challenge with females running or women running for executive positions, is you have to show you're tough, but then you also have to show you're likable. And that's a very, very narrow needle to thread for almost any woman. And so, you know, Bernie Sanders, you go to his debates or you go to his events and he yells at you for 40 minutes and you're like, and you know, and the audience is like, yeah, yell at me for 40 minutes more. They get really fired up. When Hillary Clinton gets passionate about giving a speech and she starts to yell, you know, 2 days later, Bob Woodward goes on Morning Joe and says that she's shrill. And, you know, it's very hard for a woman to telegraph passion and raising your voice because people, you know, are automatically kind of programmed to hear their mother yelling at them or a woman yelling at them as something that they've done something wrong. It's, you know, it's reactive, like mom's mad at me, right, kind of thing. And so she gets put into this box where almost where she's, you know, she can't show passion, but when she does, she becomes the, like, you know, the sort of pragmatic mom to Bernie Sanders' dad who's like, you know, wants to buy the crazy jet ski. And she's like, no, Bernie, we can't buy the crazy jet ski. But it's not very inspirational. And so young women are not responding to that. And, you know, they go to, I had this one woman who I spoke to at a Bernie Sanders event. She was 22 years old. She was so eloquent. It was really great. And she talked about how she'd been to Hillary events and to Bernie events. And if you thought of them as a first date, you know, she was like, I love the first date with Bernie. He's like revolution and he's sweeping me off my feet. She was like, I felt so inspired to change the world after going to his event. And then she was like, I went to a Hillary Clinton event and it was like going on a first date with an actuary. She was talking about my mortgage payments and my pension plans. And she was like, I know that's important, but I want passion and I want to be slipped off my feet. And I think for a female candidate, it's so difficult for Hillary to show that kind of passion without sounding angry or shrill or all the other sort of trapped words that you use with women.
All right. The strengths and the weaknesses of running as a woman to be president of the United States. We're going to take a very brief break. We'll continue this profile of Hillary Rodham Clinton with J. Newton Small and others. This is To the Point from PRI.
Check out KCRW's music blog for song premieres, music news, performances, and KCRW DJ features. Stay up to date on all of KCRW music happenings at kcrw.com/musicblog.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Worman Olney back with To the Point. In 1995, the United Nations held its fourth World Conference on Women in Beijing. The First Lady of the United States delivered the keynote address.
If there is one message that echoes forth from this conference, let it be that human rights are women's rights and women's rights are human rights once and for all.
Alida Black is a history professor at George Washington University, editor of the Eleanor Roosevelt Papers. She's also co-founder of Ready for Hillary. That's a grassroots super PAC that was created to convince Hillary Clinton to run in the 2016 presidential election. It's a super PAC that no longer exists. Alida Black, good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, I'm happy to be here, Warren. Thanks for having me.
How important was that moment in Beijing to the rest of the world, not just to Hillary Rodham Clinton?
It's hard to overestimate really the importance that Hillary's speech in Beijing had. I've gone to 15 post-conflict countries and worked with women who literally every day put their lives on the line to try to feed their families or build new governments or mitigate war in their communities. And all of them were empowered and took that speech in sort of as soul armor, if you will. I mean, you could hear in the clip that you played some of the applause that was there. But I talked to so many women who were there, and they all tell me that it was so, the reaction was so overwhelming that with the stomping of the feet and clapping, it made the building shake. And so if you look at that in terms of inspiring women and saying to the world that rape and child soldiers and forced marriage and the killing of daughters is a war crime or a human rights violation, Hillary was the first person to lay that out. And because of that speech and because of the huge support that she generated for that, the UN took notice. So you have UN Security Council Resolution 1325 and UN Security Council Resolution 1888 that specifically deal with the violation of women's rights as human rights violations. So it changed law, it inspired a movement, and it gave women around the world the additional courage that they needed to go for.
Is this something that she did just as First Lady, or do the values that she expressed, the concerns that she listed, go back further in her own life?
Oh, well, I've known about Hillary for 40 years. I first heard about Hillary in 1975 when I was running a rape crisis center in Atlanta. And I can tell you that when I was dealing with children who had been abused or women who had been violated, that everywhere I went to get legal advice, people said to me, "Do you know Hillary Rodham?" Later, when a dear friend of mine was appointed by Governor Carter to the Legal Services Corporation, and I was working on legal assaults on women's integrity, my friend Dan kept saying, "Oh my God, you have to know Hillary." So this has been a lifelong commitment of hers. This is not new. And what I would like to remind our audience is that it was not easy for Hillary to go to Beijing. The Senate didn't want her to go. The House didn't want her to go. The human rights community didn't want her to go. They were like, "Why are you going to go validate China?" And Hillary was saying, "I am not validating China. I am validating women who risk their lives." And so she was right to push so hard and go.
What about the young woman we heard earlier about from Aleta Black, the one, for example, who said that a first date with Hillary Clinton is like a first date with an actuary? Did this just happen too long ago for them to get the point?
I can't disagree with that strong enough. I don't think you can take that by one speech. I mean, I co-founded Ready for Hillary. Okay, I'm 64, everybody. I had a birthday on Saturday, and I'm taking the South Carolina victory as the best birthday present of my life. But I, with Ready for Hillary, the vast majority, every single person who organized for us, all of the 30 people staff were under 30-year-olds. They were passionate. They were eager to be involved. They saw her as tough and smart and funny. And I think one of the problems with the press talking about millennial voters is you're looking at voters, you know, who are predominantly on college campuses, and they're disproportionately white. What about young women of color in South Carolina who voted for her overwhelmingly? What about young women who are not on college campuses and are working? What about young women at community colleges who can't go to these big rallies? What about Hispanic young women What about Hispanic young men?
Okay, we're talking about a profile of Hillary Rodham Clinton. It is inevitable that we get into the campaign realities, though. But so let me go back to J. Newton Small with Time Magazine and ask, how do you respond to that? And is it an excessively a generalization to say that millennial women don't get it?
I don't think it is. I mean, at least the ones that I've spoken to, Hillary lost millennial women in New Hampshire by 82%. I mean, it was like a blowout. To say that there's no problem just is not true. I mean, certainly every poll of millennials out there shows that she has a problem with millennials, men and women. And so it's certainly a challenge for her, and it's something that her campaign itself acknowledges and says she's talking about, and she herself, in speaking to audiences, says she knows that the young people aren't with her, but she's working to get their votes, just like she's working to get other votes. Hillary Clinton lost women in 16 contests to Barack Obama in 2008 on the backs of the fact that millennials didn't really like her that much back then, and they still don't like her that much now. And she's not succeeding in making a case to them about why she is the woman to lead them. There is a millennial revolution going on right now. You see Taylor Swift talking about demanding, recognition at the Grammys. You see Jennifer Lawrence asking for equal pay, which the connection that Hillary is not making here is why she would be the right woman to lead them. And she telegraphs it. She talks about Beijing. She mentions it in her speeches. But she doesn't actually explain what Beijing is. And to every millennial out there, just to say women's rights is human rights, they're like, of course that's true. Like, they're the first generation born believing the equality of the sexes. What they don't understand is why it has to be her that has to be president. And she doesn't make that case to them enough, because she doesn't explain her history enough. And, this is a generation infamous for not doing their homework. They definitely don't know, when she talks about these things, about why she has been at the forefront of this movement for such a long time. And that's the case she's really yet to solidify and to make.
Okay, we heard a lot about that history from Alita Black. We'll get back to her in a moment. Let's go then and take another look at another stage in her life, and that is when she was First Lady of the United States. Todd Purdom is a senior writer at Politico, contributing editor at Vanity Fair, covered the Clinton administration. And Todd Purdom, it's good to have you back on our program. Thanks for
joining
us.
Glad to be with you, Warren. Glad to be here.
Tell us a little bit, if you will, about her career as First Lady and, of course, all that she went through with the trials and tribulations of her husband.
Well, yeah, I mean, she was a pioneering First Lady in a very vivid way. I mean, really, arguably not since Eleanor Roosevelt had somebody been so involved in the thick of policy and politics as she was during her husband's 8 years in office. And as Jay and Alita both correctly recall, I remember vividly when she announced that she was going to go to the Beijing summit. We were in Jackson Hole, Wyoming that summer on vacation. It was a very bold move for her to do. She went over there, and as Jay just said, people forget that, Hillary was there first on so many of these issues and things that younger voters now take for granted. She really was a pioneer in, starting with her work for the Children's Defense Fund, going all the way back to her work on the House Impeachment Committee during Watergate. She has spent, 40, almost 45 years of her life, really, in the thick of these issues. And she has the scars to prove it. I mean, she definitely paid a terrible price for the failure of the Clinton administration's health care plan. She took her lumps for that, and she then, in the wake of that, began to kind of retool herself, reinvent herself as, in a sense, the First Lady of the world, the way Eleanor Roosevelt had been. I was with her on the first big solo foreign trip she took to Nepal, India, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, where she talked about women and girls and, the importance of educating women, having microcredit available to make women be able to have small businesses in the developing world. It was remarkable to see the way she was received in, tiny village in India or Bangladesh. So she was very forward-leaning, and to borrow Sheryl Sandberg's term, she was leaning in before anyone coined the phrase, and she paid a price for it.
Paid a price and is still paying that price, I take it.
Yes, I think she's still paying the price. With a certain generation of people, she's paying the price of all those accumulated scars. And, she's been an important public figure for almost 25 years. If she becomes president, no one since Richard Nixon would have been on the national stage that long and won the White House. So one of the problems she faces in this campaign, as she did in 2008, is almost nobody is neutral about Hillary Rodham Clinton. Almost everyone knows her or thinks they know her, and almost everyone has a view of her. So she has a very high floor. Her support will never fall below a certain level. And she also has a certain ceiling above which her support is very hard to get. And the people who have negative opinions of her are very set in their views. People who have positive opinions are very set in their views. And she really has only a very small sliver of people who are undecided about how they feel about her or to whom she can appeal who don't already know her.
One of the things that Bernie Sanders is hitting very hard is her ties to Wall Street. And if that's a primary weakness, what about this comment when she was asked during a recent televised town hall why she took $675,000 in fees for three speeches to Goldman Sachs? Here's the question from Anderson Cooper of CNN.
But did you have to be paid $675,000?
Well, I don't know. That's what they offered. So, you know, every Secretary of State that I know has done that.
Todd Purdom, a lot of people have said she seemed oddly unprepared for that question.
Yes, I think she gets caught up on this issue quite a bit, and it's one of her vulnerabilities. I mean, there's famous documentation about how she's felt over the years, you know, beleaguered and besieged, that for much of her family's career, she was the principal breadwinner as a lawyer in Arkansas. Bill Clinton made, I think, around $35,000 a year as governor of Arkansas. And I really think there's a certain part of Hillary Clinton, despite the $100-plus million she and her husband have earned since leaving the White House, I really think there's some part of her, her father's daughter growing up in suburban Chicago, who thinks she might wind up in the poorhouse. And I think she's really afraid of that in some psychological way that isn't particularly rational but is deep-seated. And so I think it's very hard for her when somebody offers her a big fee to say no because she thinks she's building a nest egg for her grandchildren and her family, and I really do believe that. And I think she should think about the political implications of it more. Even many of her supporters were troubled by the Goldman speeches, especially because although she says she had not made up her mind for certain to run for president when she made the speeches, she was certainly considering it. And in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis, she certainly had to know how that would play. There's already a broad strain of criticism that her husband's administration and Secretary of the Treasury Bob Rubin had been too sympathetic to Wall Street when he was in office in the 90s. So it's a vulnerability for her that it's one of those classic unforced errors that she's capable of making from time to time.
Alita Black, let me go back to you, our history professor at George Washington University. You've known her for 40 years, you said. Does she have a tin ear in this regard?
Well, I disagree a little bit with this. I think, first of all, that a lot of people have gone around and made a lot of speeches for a lot of money. Look at Ronald Reagan, $2 million for 4 days, a week after he's president. You know, that's totally left our mind. And the Goldman Sachs speech, which I agree with Todd, you know, had an element of tin ear to it, was in support of their 10,000 Women program, which is a program that Hillary has been involved with for a long time. So I think that there is a concerted effort to get her message and to answer questions and to, you know, certainly increase the family's resources.
Okay, I'm going to interrupt you for a minute. We're going to go to a break within about a minute and a half. Before we do, I want to go just very quickly to Jonathan Allen, who's head of community and content at Sidewire. That's a social platform for political discussion, but also author of HRC, State Secrets and the Rebirth of Hillary Clinton. In what way, as Secretary of State, do you think she began to overcome some of the problems we've been hearing about? Jonathan Allen, you there?
I am. I think very much she continued a lot of that work that Alita was talking about going back 40 years and some of what Todd was talking about going back a little closer to 20 years. In particular, she talked about, continued to talk about the needs of elevating women in society to create greater economic strength and through that economic strength, greater stability for countries, particularly those in post-conflict or pre-conflict or in the middle of conflict. In addition to that, just one other quick note, as a bookend to that Beijing speech in 2011, I believe, she gave a speech in which she said gay rights are human rights and human rights are gay rights, expanding on what she had done and sort of setting the stage to create those legal protections that Alita was talking about for women on the stage for LGBT folks.
Hold that thought. We're going to take a very brief break. We'll come back. We'll hear more from Jonathan Allen and our other guests as well. On our talking point, we'll be hearing about Iran's latest election. Is the victory of moderates more than skin deep? Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcasts you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join.
We're only back with our special edition of To the Point, the profile of Hillary Rodham Clinton, tough, tested, not always trusted. We're talking now with Jonathan Allen, whose book is HRC, State Secrets and the Rebirth of Hillary Clinton. We've talked about her time in the White House. We're now focused on her time as Secretary of State. What about the emails and what about the investigation by the FBI?
Well, I think in terms of the emails, obviously that was poor judgment in terms of politics at the very least, potentially national security as well. It's the rare case where she created a system where the cover-up kind of precedes any potential crime, which is very unusual in politics. And I think they're probably too cute by half, an effort to keep people from seeing what her deliberations were, ended up blowing up in her face, and now everybody's getting a good look at it. In terms of what we've seen so far, you know, I'm not sure that what we've seen is terribly out of the ordinary. It's hard to compare it because we don't really have, I mean, obviously the volume is out of the ordinary, but in terms of the content and things that are later deemed to be classified being moved around on what are called the low side systems, meaning the unclassified systems, that still happens every day. I don't know the extent to which it happens. I don't know the extent to which you're dealing with stuff that would be later classified. And in some cases that is true, that there's, you know, sort of frequent things that get sent out that later get deemed to be classified. The FBI investigation, I don't think we have a lot of transparency into that right now. They're obviously investigating, or nobody wants the FBI in their backyard or their basement. If they find anything, even if it has nothing to do with the emails, you know, there's obviously a potential for liability there, or, you know, if they were to find something illegal, potential prosecution. That said, I think the bar for prosecuting a presidential candidate in the middle of a campaign has got to be pretty high. Prosecutors don't like to go after people if they don't think they're going to get a conviction, or if they're not sure they're going to get a conviction, particularly with a presidential election going on. I think that's something that will probably weigh on the Justice Department if the FBI recommends that there be a prosecution. And there's no evidence of that yet.
Back to Todd Purdom. You've been in Washington for a long time. If, in fact, somebody is subject to an investigation by the FBI, isn't it possible that even though the main figure, in this case Hillary Rodham Clinton, may not be accused of anything, somebody close to that person might be? Maybe they lied to the FBI or inadvertently gave misinformation of some sort to the FBI. Then they get charged with that. How does the candidate overcome that kind of thing?
Yes, you just, as John points out, you never know what's going to happen when the FBI gets on your tail or on your trail. And I mean, it seems entirely possible to me that partly for the reasons John suggested, that this, if Secretary Clinton is elected in the fall, this investigation could conceivably continue into her presidency. I don't think that it's at all possible to rule that out. And, you know, again, I'd be very careful to say it's not at all clear where it will lead. It's not at all clear whether the FBI is now conducting a kind of a pro forma investigation to be sure nothing serious happened, or whether there's more to it. But at a minimum, it starts a process that you just never know, and we've seen in the past, you never know where it's going to end. So it's definitely a vulnerability.
In the aftermath of South Carolina, and as the campaign goes on, there's no way we can talk about Hillary Clinton and the profile of her of any kind without talking about her relationship with African Americans. Michael Dyson is author of The Black Presidency, Barack Obama and the Politics of Race in America. He writes for both the New York Times and the New Republic. He's a professor of sociology at Georgetown University, and welcome to our program.
Thank you, sir.
Are we going to see, if in fact Hillary Clinton is elected president, a different kind of black presidency?
I think perhaps so. Barack Obama himself was circumscribed, hemmed in, and bounded by a historic suspicion of black people when it comes to politics, especially representative politics, and whether or not they're being loyal to a particular tribe or to the broader nation. So he was constantly belabored by that concern, and as a result of that, didn't necessarily explicitly address the issue of race in a way that, ironically, perhaps even paradoxically enough, Hillary Clinton, as a white woman, has the freedom to do so. Her husband, Bill, had historic forms of charisma and enjoyed historic forms of popularity with African-American communities. Some of that redounds to her positively, as well as the fact that she has, over the years, addressed the issues that are central to African-American people. Some have had disagreements about that, to be sure, but she has developed a coterie of friends, especially black female friends who are well-known politicians and others, who are a kind of personal firewall for her. And when it comes to the broader issues, clearly black voters have seen that Hillary Clinton speaks to their issues in a serious way, so it may indeed be a different variety of a black presidency.
You were a supporter of Barack Obama in 2008. Has Hillary Clinton, do you think, evolved since then?
Well, I think she has. I mean, in that first run for the presidency, that she undertook in 2008, there were some troubling racial signifiers that were going on, some racial innuendo and the like about white voters who were working hard about a phone call at 3 a.m. But I think that she has evolved in terms of understanding that in her conversations with the Black Lives Matter movement, which she has, of course, engaged and they have engaged her, she understands the necessity to address the animus, the anti-black sentiment that is present, but she's also said that we have to deal with the structural issues that don't easily get dismissed with personal sentiment. So she has understood the need to come forward with public policy. I think that her strength will be addressing the needs of African American communities with a sensitivity that President Obama couldn't necessarily publicly display, along with a powerful public policy that could address those needs as well.
What about Bill Clinton and the tough on crime movement that has led to the mass incarceration that is now such a problem and being deplored in so many ways? She was certainly a part of that, was she not?
She certainly was, along with Bernie Sanders, who voted for the bill. Hillary Clinton may have expressed sentiments of support for it. Senator Sanders, of course, Congressman and Senator, cast his ballot for that piece of legislation. But to be fair, many black people were in favor of it as well. Of course, those of us who opposed it were quite vocal, too. But many people felt that something had to be done about the extraordinary rates of crime in black communities. Bill Clinton was sold in part by some black advisors on the belief that crack cocaine was more powerful than powder cocaine and led to devastating and deleterious social consequences for black people. So there's a context there within which that must be interpreted. Yes, that bill has been horrible, feeding and fueling the mass incarceration of African-American people, but it would be a bit too precious, morally speaking, for people now to take the high road when in the midst of the circumstance itself, many people were quite concerned about the consequences of crime in these communities and how they would be addressed within the broader political framework.
She won the votes of black people in South Carolina almost 9-1 over Bernie Sanders. Do you think that'll continue?
I do. Hillary Clinton continues to show her strength among African-American people. It has been said that Senator Sanders went to South Carolina and basically ran a white liberal northern approach, if you will, campaign. And Hillary Clinton understands the politics on the ground. Not only her ground game is superior, but her relationships are more long-lasting, and her evident commitment to the issues that black people confront, I think, projects her far more profoundly over that of Senator Sanders.
Let me go back to Jonathan Allen again with Sidewire, author of HRC, State Secrets and the Rebirth of Hillary Clinton. I want to talk a little bit more about this rebirth idea. There are those who have said that during the Clinton administration, as we have heard from Todd Purdom and others, life was difficult for the First Lady. Then, of course, she became a senator. And then when she went to the State Department, there are those who have said She was able to relax a bit. Is that part of what you mean by the rebirth of Hillary Clinton? And if so, what does that mean? And what does it mean particularly in terms of the kinds of policies that she might favor as President of the United States?
I think there was a little bit of a liberating aspect, obviously, after a tough campaign in 2008. But actually, the terminology behind rebirth was more about the political rebirth of Hillary Clinton, about the decision to go work for Barack Obama, which I think was a signal. I think it's she's reaping the benefits now. I think was a signal to African Americans and others that even after being defeated by Barack Obama, she was willing to go work for him, willing to go support his administration. You know, aside from the you know news story here or there, there was very very little tension or conflict between them during that time. I think she used her time at the State Department to build a foreign policy resume that she didn't have in 2008, even though she had claimed it. You know, she had been sort of mocked by Senator Obama for not having as much substance behind what she said when she talked about taking that 3 a.m. phone call. She obviously had not been the one on the other line. It was President Clinton who had been during the White House years. And also you had President Clinton fighting some political battles out there, clearing space for her political rebirth, going and helping the opponents of people who had opposed her in Democratic primaries and sending a little bit of a chill through the Democratic world in terms of what it meant to oppose the Clintons, that maybe 4, 6, or 8 years down the road, Bill Clinton would show up in your district and help somebody else win a campaign. So the rebirth aspect was more about that political rebirth, about how she regained her footing. I do think there is some liberation. I do think that when you hear her talking on the road now about issues of importance, particularly to women, about issues of importance to minorities, to African Americans, to Latinos, that jives a lot better with who she was before she ran for president in 2008 than how she ran in 2008. And I think she's perhaps a little more comfortable in her own skin now because it's a little more true to her. The world has moved a little bit toward the values that she had in her youth. And so I think that's a little more comfortable for her as well.
Let me go back to our very first guest, J. Newton Small, political correspondent for Time magazine, author of Broad Influence, How Women Are Changing the Way Washington Works. It's often said that Hillary Clinton has a pretty tough skin, as one would assume, given all that she has been through. But that's particularly true, apparently, with regard to the media and, of course, to Congress as well. What about Benghazi? And her reaction to the attacks that have been made on her about that issue. How much of a difficulty is she going to have, do you think, dealing with that as the campaign goes on?
If you talk to her campaign, she definitely talks about, they talk about Benghazi as if it was a strength and not a weakness because there, you know, she had 11 hours in front of Trey Gowdy, who was a Republican heading the Benghazi committee in the House. And after 11 hours, they produced pretty much nothing except positive news for Hillary Clinton. And so they're very, you know, they're not so worried about a general campaign where Benghazi becomes such a big issue because she feels that she's answered every single possible question she could answer and has put the issue to rest. So I don't think it'll be that much of a deal.
Todd Purdom, back to you with Politico and Vanity Fair. How about the press and her relationship with the press? So important, given the role of perception in a presidential campaign.
Yes, well, I mean, what never must be forgotten is that her introduction to the national press in presidential politics was in 91 and 92, and it was in the context of Jennifer Flowers and the draft and one controversy after another. And she was stung deeply and bitterly and badly by that. And in some real sense, she's never recovered in terms of her ability to deal comfortably with the press. It's always an occasion of concern and stress and tension for her. I've seen her in private moments where she's quite funny, quite engaging. She has a very wicked sense of humor. It's dangerous for her to show it precisely because it is a kind of a wicked sense of humor, and that is a sense that's very sharp-edged and can be very funny. It's not a kind of a yucky sense of humor. But in the past, when she's made jokes about whether it's, you know, staying home and baking cookies or what have you, they have sometimes boomeranged against her because not everyone hears them the way she intended them to come out. So I think it's hard for her. She doesn't easily let down her guard. She doesn't easily make new friends, as John pointed out, and Michael Eric Dyson. She has a cadre of very loyal friends who've been with her for many years. Her staff has been remarkably, her core inner group of advisors has been remarkably consistent over the years and remarkably loyal. Sometimes I think they must all be a little bit exhausted by now, simply because they have been, you know, some of them really one way or another with her for 25 years, and it's a tremendous pressure cooker. But I think, you know, no one will ever accuse Hillary Clinton of not doing her homework, and no one will ever accuse her of not working harder than the hardest, you know, working baby in show business, as they say. So I think that, you know, she knows what's coming better than anybody. She's prepared for it. Will she always handle it in the optimum way? Probably not. But she will. I don't think she's going to be surprised by too much that's going to happen in the fall.
Alida Black, back to you at George Washington University, editor of the Eleanor Roosevelt Papers, co-founder of Ready for Hillary, who wanted Hillary Clinton to run. Is she going to be able, do you think, to find a way to make herself more authentic, more trustworthy to those who answer polls by saying, in large numbers, they're not sure they trust her?
Well, I think all you have to do is look at Hillary in South Carolina. She was so open there and so much the woman that I know. And the more the country sees this and the more relaxed and brave Hillary gets, I think that she will be able to, you know, to overcome some of this. It is going to be a fight. She's the most well-known, unknown woman in the history of the world, I think. And I agree with John very much and Michael very much, both of whom I know, and we've done dog and pony shows together, with their comments about what Hillary learned from state and also the latitude that the racial crisis in America gives Hillary to really let people see the woman that she is.
Very quickly, back to Michael Dyson. Do you think that, of course, we saw the record in South Carolina, but will, if she is, in fact, the nominee, Hillary Clinton be able to energize the black vote? Will they turn out for her? They were so important to the victory of President Obama both times around. She's really going to need that.
Certainly. And I think, look, black people vote Democratic overwhelmingly to begin with. Barack Obama boosted it to new and stellar heights. He's not going anywhere. Should Hillary Clinton receive the nomination, as I expect she will, Barack and Michelle Obama will vigorously contest for her. He wants to preserve his legacy. He knows Hillary Clinton is critical to that. She understands that she's critical in that role as well. And so there's a kind of sublime symbiosis between them. And I think that black people will be reminded of the high stakes of this particular election. And I think she's going to do quite well.
Many thanks to you all. Michael Dyson, again, at Georgetown University, writer for the New York Times and the New Republic. His book, The Black Presidency, Barack Obama and the Politics of Race in America. Thanks to Jonathan Allen with Sidewire. His book, HRC, State Secrets and the Rebirth of Hillary Clinton. Todd Purdom, senior writer at Politico, contributing editor at Vanity Fair. Alida Black at George Washington University, editor of the Eleanor Roosevelt Project. And J. Newton Small, political correspondent for Time Magazine, author of Broad Influence, How Women Are Changing the Way Washington Works. Great to have you all. We'll see what happens next. Iran's latest elections. What do they mean for the Islamic Republic and for the United States? Back in a moment with today's talking point on To the Point.
Subscribe to KCRW's Today's Top Tune Download podcast. To receive a free song of the day, find today's top tune on KCRW's iTunes page.
Norman Olney here with today's talking point. Before Iran's recent parliamentary elections, 90% of reformed-minded candidates were screened out of the running. Nonetheless, so-called moderates did score victories, not just in parliament, but in the Assembly of Experts, which might well choose the next supreme leader. Trita Parsi is president of the National Iranian American Council. He's author of A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. Welcome back to our program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Was this, in Iran, a referendum on what we refer to in this country as the nuclear deal?
I think it very much was so. I mean, it really came down to that issue, and a lot of people voted not necessarily for people they even knew of or liked, but they voted against people who stood for ideas that they had come to be convinced needed to be rejected. It was a very, very strong rejection of the conservative bloc, their ideas, their approach. A sense has emerged very strongly amongst the population that the Rouhani government's more moderate approach is much better for Iran. It has yielded results. It has lifted sanctions. Iran has a better relationship, not just with Europe, but frankly also a better relationship today now with the United States. And this is the direction they want to go. And more than anything else, they want to make sure that the parliament, as well as the assembly of experts, is not dominated by people who have done everything they could to undermine that process.
Who are we talking about if, in fact, 90% of the people who wanted to be reformers were rejected and not even allowed to run in the first place?
Well, what that shows is that ultimately this is still not in any way, shape, or form an election that we can call fully democratic. But the more important point is that the people, recognizing all of these flaws and all of these attempts by hardliners to skew the process to their own favor, recognize that by going out and voting, they could still defeat the hardliners. And in spite of all of these efforts to cheat and to make the process loop-sided, the hardliners failed. So the people who ran at the end of the day, and this is important to understand, it's not just because you're a reformist that you're in favor of this new direction and you support the Iran deal and you support Rouhani's platform. That's a platform that has support from a variety of people, most of them centrist and moderates, as well as some conservatives. There were several conservatives that actually ran on a list supported by Rouhani and his group.
How can you say that relations with the United States have improved when we still have a government that supports Assad in Syria, that supports Hamas, that supports Hezbollah in Lebanon, and factions in Iraq that are contrary to what Americans regard as their interests?
I think that's a great question. It reminds us of the fact that just because there has been an improvement in relationship doesn't mean that there's now normalized or good relations between the two countries. But this is not a binary issue. If we're expecting that relations cannot improve until all of those things that you mentioned happen, well, then we're probably going to wait a very, very long time. But it has improved in the sense that there are now direct communications between the two sides that have proven to be significantly valuable. So when you have 10 American sailors veering off unintentionally into Iranian waters and get caught by IRGC Navy, something that probably would have taken a year minimum to resolve in previous instances, now got resolved in 16 hours. That's pretty important.
What about Republican candidates, Ted Cruz, for example, who are saying that if, in fact, they are elected to President of the United States, he's certainly not the only one, they will tear up the Iran nuclear deal? How is that received in Iran by both hardliners and by people that you refer to as moderates?
Well, let me first say this. People all around the world are concerned about the U.S. elections, mindful of what is taking place right now. But certainly people in...
Okay, we seem to have lost the contact with Trita Parsi. Once again, he is president of the National Iranian-American Council, author of A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. We're trying to find out from him as we labor to reestablish contact exactly what the consequences of this most recent election are. Once again, a large number of people referred to as reformers who really want to change the nature of the system were not allowed to vote in the election. But here he is back again, Trita Parsi. So let me ask you to begin again with the answer to my question about the way in which the American campaign is being perceived in Iran, particularly the promise by Republican candidates to tear up the Iran nuclear deal.
Yes. So I would say a lot of people all around the world are quite concerned about what is happening in the American elections. But in Iran in particular, clearly there is a concern because there's now been an agreement. And when you have presidential candidates saying that they're going to tear it up on day one, obviously that is causing some concern. But what is tempering that concern is the awareness that if the deal is properly implemented in the next 11 months and everything goes well and the IEA continues to verify that everyone has done what they're supposed to and are obligated to do under the deal, then if a Republican president comes in and tries to unravel the deal, he's not only putting himself on a collision course with Iran, but primarily putting America on a collision course with the European states, with Russia, with China, with India, with the entire international community who have backed this deal, with the exception of Israel and Saudi Arabia. So I think a lot of people view this as bluster at this point, perhaps an effective fundraising strategy, because you might get more funding from some specific individuals who are very much opposed to the deal. But whether they actually will be able to do it very much depends on whether the deal is successfully implemented in the next 11 months. If it is, it's going to be very tough and extremely costly to undo it. If there's problems in the implementation, well, then it's a completely different story.
Let's just go back quickly to the history of Iran itself. In 2001, there was an election won by Mohammad Khatami, who was, in fact, a reformist. And a lot of people at that point in Iran and elsewhere had great hopes for the liberalization of that country. That certainly hasn't happened. And this election is not a step in that direction, is it?
Not at all. I think what was really fascinating, I would make the argument that the elections has been a vindication of Obama's outreach to Iran. Because in 2001, the United States and Iran collaborated behind the scenes against the Taliban. The Iranian role was instrumental, according to folks working for the Bush administration at the time. But as soon as Iran's help was deemed no longer necessary, President Bush put them in the axis of evil. So Iranian collaboration rewarded them with an inclusion in the axis of evil. And that eventually got the thing so bad, so you had someone like Ahmadinejad elected. Now you have a scenario in which President Obama has rewarded Iranian moderation and compromise on the nuclear issue with sanctions relief, with Iran's inclusion in international negotiations over Syria.
But what do you say, excuse me for interrupting you, but we're running short of time. What do you say to Americans who say, wait a minute, the Iranians are just biding their time, and what they really want is a nuclear weapon, and all we've done is delay the process?
The deal's core element is the fact that the Iranians are now implementing and are going to permanently put into place the additional protocol, which means that some of the most important aspects of this deal when it comes to verification and having insight into what Iran is doing is going to be permanent. It's not something that's going to expire after 15 years.
Okay.
All the paths for Iran to go for a nuclear weapon, frankly, has been closed off by this deal.
All right. Great many things to talk about. Once again, the election has, in fact, led to an unexpected result. Trita Parsi with the National Iranian American Council, author of A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. Many thanks, as always. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast at a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
Public Radio International.